Yes, so continuing what my mother told me, that Charlie had said that fortunately other junior officers overheard this conversation between, with an interpreter, between the Japanese commandant and the senior British officer, some colonel. And he, the Japanese commandant, said, if you allow your medical staff to treat my soldiers and officers, and I know that quite a few of you are in the Royal Army, British Royal Army Medical Corps, because there was a whole squad of you, not a regiment, but a large number of you that were put into Changi together, and you've all been moved up into Siam together. So although you no longer have the epaulettes and the insignia, I know a lot of you are Royal Army medical people. If you allow them to treat my soldiers when they're ill or broken leg or whatever, I will ensure that your rations, and that will be doubled, plus you will all get the medical treatment you need, because I will order medicine and equipment from our headquarters. In other words, a quid pro quo. And the senior colonel, British, said, over my dead body, no, we will not allow. But he was overruled by the junior officers, the subalterns, and that who said, no, this is foolish, sir, because it means more of us will survive. They will get their comeuppance when we achieve victory over them, because we are going to win, you see. But what's the good if we're all dead? Whereas, if we do this small service for them, it ensures we're fed better, we're treated better, we can treat our own men more efficiently, because he says he's going to have medical supplies sent from the Japanese medical headquarters. All in all, it's a good deal, and they overruled. It's like mutiny on the Bounty. If he hadn't agreed, they would have demoted him, taken over, put him in irons or whatever. But it was a good deal, and we think that is how Charlie survived, because he did have this knowledge. He was quite skillful, and he obviously, although he wasn't proud, or he didn't sort of want to talk about treating Japanese officers and that. But there's a little bit of the Hippocratic Oath, where he wasn't a doctor, but still, I suppose he had that feeling that if somebody is in pain or sick or broken leg or something, you feel a human, from the point of view of humanity, you have an obligation to do what you can, even though they're the enemy. And the better, after that, as I understand it, the whole attitude of the Japanese NCOs and officers changed. So instead of treating the British like scum who surrendered and no better than a cockroach, that was the most common word that the Japanese used against the British, Canadian and Australian soldiers and all that, was the Japanese for cockroach, which is really low in Japanese language, because they surrendered instead of fighting. That's what made them treat the prisoners of war so horribly, because they were considered to be not really, they didn't stand up, they weren't men, they were insects, because they were despised, because the British high command had decided to surrender, which was a wise thing to do, because they would have been slaughtered and wiped out if they hadn't. But from the Japanese point of view, that was the most dishonourable thing to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they were all treated. That's why they used to whip them with a butt, smack them in the face with the butt of their rifles, and trip them up into ditches full of shit. Anything, because they despised them. But in this particular camp where Charlie was, after that quid pro quo arrangement, the Japanese realised, perhaps they began to realise, that these were just human beings the same as them, and it wasn't their fault that they surrendered. It wasn't, they are victims like we are, you know, and you can't have a couple of British medical people treating your officer and curing him, perhaps in, you know, like, I don't know, I don't know any, perhaps preventing gangrene or something, in a terribly wounded leg or something. You can't have that happening, and then the next minute, smack them round the face or hit them with the butt of your gun and call them cockroach. You know, it sort of, it changed the whole attitude. And
did your brother Charlie's attitude change through his war experience, I think? Did he?
Well, he was very reserved, and even before the war, what my brother Sid and I think is that by nature he was a pacifist, really, more so perhaps than we were, because I mean he was a non-violent person. He abhorred violence and aggression of any kind. He was artistic. He played the guitar and the first classical music I ever heard was coming from his little gramophone. He used to buy classical records, and in his little bedroom, with the door shut and trying to keep out the shouting and hollering and the general hubbub of a family of with Jack and my sister Helen and Sid and me. You know, there's a lot of noise, but we used to shut the door and listen to his music. Mandolin, that was the instrument I was trying. He used to play the mandolin beautifully. And nevertheless, he felt obliged to do his bit because of the horror of the war, and with his medical knowledge. And that's why he volunteered for the Royal Army Medical Corps.
And back to
when he came back, he didn't talk about his experience except to my mother. He was very close to my mother, but he hardly spoke about it to us. And he knew we were both COs. He never once criticised us. He never once demanded an explanation or justification. So I think, you know, he was a good fella, on the right wavelength, even though, you know, he suffered all those, and he didn't hate the Japanese. Well, he hated the military. See, that's another you learn. He hated the nationalistic, brain dead military, as he used to call them, only thinking of victory and not caring about how many lives are lost. He used to say they, a bit like in the First World War, it might cost us 50,000 men, but we will advance, we'll take this island or whatever. And the Japanese thought like that. The lives were, didn't have any value to the hierarchy. The hierarchy, he hated them, but he didn't hate the ordinary Japanese people, the ordinary Japanese squaddy, because he could, sometimes they were, I mean, if they did something to offend an officer, they got the same treatment as the British PO, as the Allied POWs. I mean, he treated quite a few Japanese squaddies whose injuries were caused by their own officers, out of spite and nastiness and not enough deference. That, oh shit, the deference. My mother used to say, at first it was obnoxious, the bowing and scraping, but after a while, Charlie told Mum, you get used to it. And you, like, when he had to go into one of their huts to treat a Japanese, you know, he'd walk in bowing, you know, three or four times quite low down, even though he was a, what was his rank, sergeant, I think, equivalent of a, yes, he was a sergeant in the Royal, and the bloke who's lying on the bed with a broken arm or something is an ordinary Japanese private. But because they're the victors and you're the vanquished, you have to bow low, and he's bowing low and low. And if it's an officer, it goes on for longer, and you bow lower. But apparently, in your mind, you're thinking, "Survive! I'll survive! I will survive this." And anything, why should I stand on dignity? Sod them! You know, I mean, if it means survival, because they'd shoot you if you if he walked in without bowing, they'd take him out and chop his fucking head off for not showing respect to a Japanese soldier, even though it's just a private. So I mean, they chopped heads off like nobody's business, with dignity, as they thought. They'd have all these men lined up, and they would say a few words in Japanese, and you have to be punished, some punishment. And the officer comes along with a bloody great sword and whack, 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 and there's all the heads rolling in the trench where you're going to be buried. And to them, that was like an honourable death. Weird, a weird military attitude. And he survived all that, as did many others. And probably, for all I know, all those that did survive, of course, thousands and thousands died of malaria, disease, dysentery. Oh, God, terrible, terrible. But of all those that survived, I wouldn't mind betting that the vast majority of them survived because they took on board what had to be done, the deference to the Japanese. They accepted their lot for the time being and didn't kick against the traces or try to be big-headed or aggressively nationalistic, patriotic or anything like that.
Yeah.
They went along with whatever was demanded of them. And I think that's how Charlie survived, which is a wise attitude, because life is everything, and you seeing all your mates dying around you, you would want to know how to survive it. 3.5 bloody years, it's a long time, living on rice. And one nice thing was that he did tell us about this. He wouldn't tell us about the military side of it very much, or his experiences, but this he did tell us. He used to tell funny, that's it. He used to, anything humorous he would tell us, because there were humorous situations. He said there was a fight once in the hut, if you can call it a hut. It's just a few sticks with slats nailed together with holes in. He said there was a fight once, and when we found out what it was all about, it was this Scot was asking this other bloke to put out the candle because it was attracting the mosquitoes. And the other bloke was saying what, and he was trying to read a bit of paper that he'd picked up something, or he'd found a book or something, he was trying to read it. And this Scot was saying something to him, and he didn't know what it was. And he's carrying on. In the end, the Scot got out of his bunk and clouted the other bloke round the head and started fighting. And stop. What's it all about? Well, the bloke that had the candle alight and was reading this bit of paper said, he keeps saying something to me, I don't know what he's talking about. And the bloke says, I've taught him over and over again, Piotr O'Connell. For fuck's sake, Piotr O'Connell. And somebody else in this hut says, oh, hang on a minute, say that again, Piotr the fucking Connell. He says, I think he's saying put out the candle. And it took him about 10 minutes to work out what the fucking hell this bloke was, this broad Scot accent, Piotr Connell. I remember that. I can see Charlie sitting there laughing his head off, and other incidents, misunderstandings mostly, yeah. Humorous things. And what was that? There was something else I was going to say before that diverted me. The people, the locals, that's right. He mentioned that all the local agricultural people, the agricultural workers, and the land all around was commandeered, of course, by the Japanese. All the supplies, had to be brought to the camp for the Japanese. And all the prisoners of war had was rice and some strange thing that used to come in 20-pound drums, which was some sort of concentrate. Charlie thought it was the dredges from abattoirs, the waste from abattoirs boiled up in these drums with a bit of salt mixed with it, because sometimes you'd see like bits of blood vessels and what he reckoned about, but he wouldn't say anything to the others. I mean, they thought it was what, like beef concentrate, and they'd make a kind of salt beef, a meat sauce to put on the rice. That's all they had day after day for months. And sometimes it was fish, similar, in big drums, concentrated. Fish, which he said smelt terrible, but tasted okay, actually. Like when it was first opened. And that also was probably waste from a fish processing plant. And he said, I'm pretty sure the meat version was from abattoirs, because although the others didn't recognize, with my medical knowledge, I could tell a main artery or a bit of the cow's three stomachs, like tripe and all that, but bits of heart and stuff like that. Well, he said it was, providing it was sterile, it's protein and it's nutritious, and I used to encourage all the others to eat it. It's good beef stock. I mean, it's a good beef sauce, put it on your rice and eat it. And it never did it, never seemed to do anybody any harm. But anyway, so officially the locals weren't supposed to provide anything for the prisoners of war. It was absolutely, they were shot, anything. There was an imaginary barrier. All the supplies, the local supplies, went to the Japanese messes. Eggs, fruit, bread. They used some sort of unleavened bread that the locals made, the Japanese used to get. And it was absolutely forbidden on pain of death to supply the prisoners of war with anything. But in spite of that, they used to watch out where the POWs were working that day, see where they were walking, and see them stop and start digging or whatever. And they would creep through the trees and the scrub and all that, and put little green, so that it was camouflaged. They'd wrap food in green leaves and put them along like a yard, 2 yards away from where the prisoners of war were working. Every 5 yards or so, there'd be a ball like wrapped up in green leaves, which you couldn't see, it's disguised, you see. The Japanese could, and they were so clever, you never saw them, because they were all covered in green leaves hanging from their hat. And every now and then you'd break off for a pee or a crap. And they must have learnt Japanese for, I need a pee or I need a crap or whatever, because you had to ask permission. So I suppose you soon learn a few words. Just, yeah, what about you? And then you'd open it up as fast as you could. There'd be, they used to do a rice ball with an egg inside. That was one they used to do for them. Another one was fish. There was a lot of fish in the river. The POWs could have supplied themselves with, there was a river nearby, they could have supplied themselves with fish from the river, but they weren't allowed to. But these locals used to smoked fish, also in a rice ball, wrapped in a green leaves, and other things, sometimes fruit wrapped in a green leaf. And every now and then somebody would break off. The important thing was they learnt that, like this group of locals, there'd be five of these regular and spaced out at regular distances. And it was very, very important that they were all found and eaten somehow or other. You might say to somebody, if you've got a dodgy tummy and you couldn't eat all of it, you'd say to somebody, you better have a pee just by that tree there, where that branch is sticking out at an angle, and see that creeper hanging from it? You better have a pee behind that tree in a minute. Right. And then you go and finish it off. Because if the Japs discovered any of these, for bits of food and that, they'd go hunting for the locals. It was a straight, they needed to have, so they were frightened the locals would help them to escape. Once they started, if they allowed the locals to give the POWs food and that, and get friendly with them, they might aid them in trying to escape. So they wanted to complete, they wanted the locals to be completely cut off from the prisoners of war. But in spite of the dangers, the locals did do their best, you know, and they did aid and assist escapees. Oh, plenty of them. I mean, they would put them in their store. You know, they used to, they had holes with lined with straw, covered with slats of wood, and that is to keep the animals away, but to allow the rice or wheat or whatever, it's sort of storage, keeps it cool and allows it to breathe. They used to hide them down there and then cover them with a layer of whatever, food, but allow enough space for the air to get in. And they did help quite a number of POWs to escape, which was very brave of them, because the Japanese would have had no compunction in perhaps one, for every prisoner they helped, they might slaughter five of the able-bodied men of the village. You see, they had no compunction about doing that. So all in all, as Charlie would say, you learn a lot as a prisoner of war. You learn how to, when in Rome, do as the Romans do in order to survive. You learn that in spite of the enormous dangers, humanity speaks to humanity in the form of aid and assistance and food at great risk to themselves. And they just must have taken pity on seeing these poor European skinny, don't, you know, some, many of them obviously on the point of death, being worked to death. Charlie used to say, I wish I could speak the local language, because what I would have liked to have asked them for is medicine from their leaves and their knowledge of bark and leaves and all that, which could have, because often we were short of any kind of medicine, and it would have been nice to have had the locals supply us with some of the medicines from the forests that they obviously knew about from generation after generation, which now, of course, Western people are learning about. But even then, Charlie knew that they had a great knowledge of herbs and all sorts of ways of using the produce of the forest for medical purposes. I mean, how he knew that, I don't know, but he seemed to know that, and perhaps he read about it. But unfortunately, because he couldn't speak the language, there's no way of letting them know what it was he wanted. He didn't get any help there. But he came home. We fattened him up. He was very quiet. And then we, you know, Sid and I are saying, God, what's he going to say when he discovers we were COs? What's he going to say when he sees that no uniforms around and us not talking about our army experiences? Because he wouldn't have known anything about this, you see. The information, you know, the knowledge about our experiences as COs came out, and we were very anxious, very apprehensive as to how he would react. But much to our relief and surprise, he was incredibly tolerant and understanding. You know, he didn't. He said, "I can quite understand."
When had he been called up?
About a year before they sent him to Singapore. Now, the fall of Singapore was He was called up not at the outbreak, but soon after. It must have been 1940, 39 War broke out in 1939. I think he must have been, because he was much older than us, you see. He was born during the First World War. So he was of military age right at the beginning of the Second World War. How old was he? When was he called up? Probably 40, 41. 42, 43, 44. No, it must have been 40. Because if he was 3.5 years as a prisoner of war, and then the war in Asia ended, which was late, which was not until 1946, was it? When was victory victory over the Japanese? That was
That would have been August 1945.
Autumn 45, yeah. Right. So if we go back... 3.5 years, 45, 44, 43, 42, 41 and a half. Must have been called up in 1941 sometime.
Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in December 1941.
Well, that must have been perhaps sometime before then. In 1941 he must have been called up. That's right. And blow me, he was called up and then... all the training and that, because they still have to learn how to fire a rifle, although he said he never would. That's what I understand anyway. But even in the Royal Army Medical, they had to do a parade drill and learn how to fire a rifle. Where the COs who were directed to the Royal Army Medical Corps as stretcher bearers or medical orders, whether they had to learn to fire a rifle, I don't know. I'm not sure about that. They should not have been, because they were objecting to killing people. So, but in his case, he didn't mind being called up, because he saw a need to fight the war. But as a right, so he was trained. But then he went all through that, and I can't remember the exact sequence. But all I know is that they unloaded the ship. The troop ship at Singapore unloaded all the goods while the Japanese are watching, of course, from a distance. Submarines. They go, that looks a good load of supplies. There's petrol, there's diesel, there's petrol being unloaded, there's all food and everything. How many troops there? They'll be useful for building a railway. They were planning it all months before, the Japs, waiting for the British sent massive supplies to Singapore to hold back the Japanese, and where were the guns? The guns were pointing inland, I think, and the Japanese came in by the sea. The guns were pointing the wrong way, I know that. Hundreds of these mortars and cannon were all pointing the wrong way, and they were unturnable, like fixed concrete bases. And the Japanese just said, "Oh well, we won't come that way. We'll come from the other direction. Thank you." And Charlie reckoned that the Japanese had been planning it for months. And the more ships that arrived with supplies, the better it was. And when they judged that the Japanese had got enough supplies from the British, well, the Allies. Ships came from Australia full of frozen lamb and all that, and they put them into cold storage. New Zealand. And flour. Sugar and all for the troops, for this great massive pushback up from Singapore through that the Allies were going to do to push the Japanese back. Of course, you need a lot of supplies for that and a lot of troops. And then one day the Japs said, "Right, that's enough," and they just came in and it fell. And Charlie had only been there a fortnight. He was just getting on his feet and organising the medical, treatment rooms and all that, and asking for supplies of this, that, and the other, and can we have an X-ray machine or whatever, and more bandages, and a fortnight later, about 4 o'clock in the morning, about 500,000 Japanese arrived from. I can't remember whether the guns were pointing out at sea and the Japs came over land. Was that the way it went? Or was it the other way? Oh, they the Allies thought it would be a sea invasion. All the guns were How do you know about this? You read
I've heard about it.
Yeah. All the guns were pointing out to sea, but the Japs were already... they had all their reserve army all the way up the peninsula, hidden in trenches and beautifully
camouflaged.
They were camouflaged. And the strange thing is, Charlie said, every day there'd be three or four reconnaissance planes would fly up the peninsula to see if there were any Japanese, and they'd come back saying, no, there's no Japanese there. Can't see a thing. And there are half a million of them, all hidden under trees and fronds and camouflage, or in underground bunkers. I mean, they were. There's no doubt they worked a good one there, the Japs. You've got to give them credit, because not only did they occupy Singapore, but they took over massive supplies of armaments and weapons and food and everything, and two cargo ships that were still parked in the harbour unloading. The first thing they did was to paint new names on, in Japanese, Victory on one, and what was the other one? Oh, I can't remember. They said, "This is our these are our ships now. You're prisoners of war." All the crew, all the merchant navy blokes. I mean, only there. I mean, merchant navy. They're not combat troops. They were all taken as prisoners. Some quite young. I mean, when they were all packed into Changi prison, which, by the way, was a British prison. For local malcontents, and you know, some of those top prison warders got their comeuppance in Changi, because some of the inmates when the Japanese invaded were British troops on remand after a court martial, ready to be sent to the glass house back in England or in Burma or India then. British military glass houses, prisons in India, because India hadn't been invaded yet. It wasn't. Anyway, of course, when the Japanese invaded, they didn't distinguish between prison warders and prisoners. They were all banding together. And many of those awful, awful, sadistic, cruel prison warders got their comeuppance in no small measure with the prisoners, you know, I mean, in the same cell or... You know, just along the road. What? It's our fucking turn now. Wallop. Oh, they got their own back there. Charlie said that was the only good thing about it. That some of these bastards got their... I mean, some of them were awful. Military. Sergeants in the military police. Sadistic. Chosen for their absolute absence of any humanity or compassion. Really nasty, nasty people. Who enjoyed humiliating and hurting people. And Charlie said that was the only good thing about us all being bunged in the Changi prison. They turned the bloody tables on some of those sadistic bastards. And they didn't survive the war, you can rest assured. But anyway, so a fortnight after he's there, they all bunged in the Changi. And, you know, whereas it should be two to a cell, they were about 18 to a cell. I mean, it was really awful. And then dysentery and cholera and typhoid and typhus broke out because people had... I mean, there was no toilet. There were toilet facilities in the prison when it had 700 inmates, but now there were 7,000 or 10,000 all packed in. It was hell. And the Japanese realised that it could spread the diseases and all the awful... unsanitary conditions could spread to there. I mean, typhoid and typhus and cholera and all the rest of it, they're no respecter of persons. And so that's when they started moving these prisoners out of Singapore, out of Changi prison, inland, to do their work for them, which was a sensible move from the hygiene. To start with, the Allied prisoners in Changi, and it must have been hell in there, were glad to get out and march in the fresh air. But that march turned out sometimes to be a 3-week non-stop march without any food or hardly anything. And of course, at first it's lovely, get out of Changi, walking along in the country, forests and all the sweet smell of the trees, and then, you know, on and on and on and on, and they're starting to drop because of lack of food and fatigue and malnutrition and malaria, of course. Charlie had malaria all the rest of his life. He had bouts of it, and he used to get different treatments. I mean, that's another thing. We used to say to him, how did you survive malaria without any quinine or treatment? Well, he said, I used to eat a different grass or leaf every day, hoping one of them might be useful. Or, if not, one of them would be deadly poisonous, toxic, and I'd drop down dead, one or the other. That's, he used to grab, oh, I haven't seen that one before, and he'd grab a handful and chew it and eat it. He said, I don't know if any of them did my malaria any good, but sometimes I felt quite lightheaded afterwards. I think some of them were, no, but what's the word, the generic word for that, for something that makes you, give you a high.
Like aphrodisiac.
He said some of them would, well, in modern language, some of them would give me a high. And you could forget your troubles. Your mind would start imagining all sorts of weird things. But others, he said, I thought, this looks as if it might help the malaria. He just, you know, take a chance. But, of course, these long marches saw off half of them, the troops. And then when they arrived, instead of arriving at a prisoner of war camp, they arrived at a hard labour camp. And that was another shock, because they're all saying, hang on a minute, under the Hague, they all knew about the Hague Convention. Under the Hague Convention, you mustn't make prisoners work for you. You've got to feed us and treat us for medical, you know, give medical treatment, and then wait for the end of the war and hand us over. And any Japanese that spoke English and heard all this, or had it interpreted, very often they'd have an interpreter. Some poor little college student who's been whipped out of Tokyo College because he speaks a bit of English. And strange, Charlie used to feel sorry for those because they used that Japanese used to punish the messenger. Torn between translating literally and embroidering or subduing the import of what is being, some bloody British officer, all full of stuff and nonsense, all nationalistic and bombastic, says, we refuse to. And this interpreter's got to say in Japanese what the British officer says. Well, if he translated it literally, the Japanese officer would smack the interpreter around the face. How dare you? I mean, it sounds crazy, but all this honor and responsibility culture of the Japanese is very weird, because what was the interpreter supposed to do? Tell? Well, in time they learned to say, the British officer, in Japanese he'd say, the British officer says, with your permission and very respectfully, would it be possible, if you would so wish, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. Whereas the British have actually said, I bloody well demand, you know, and the interpreters. Anyway, the British officers used to march up to the commandant's thing and say, under the Geneva Convention, we're not going to do any work. We're not your slaves. You mustn't work us. You must feed us, give us manpower, and then release us when the war's over. And you must do your best to keep us fit and healthy. The Japanese commandant, when they was trying, would laugh. They'd laugh their fucking heads off. What Geneva Convention? Piss off. Get working. Here's the shovel. Dig. And all that Geneva Convention stuff about how to treat prisoners of war, either they didn't know or they didn't want to know. And so, you know, all different different things. Charlie and 500 or 600 others were working first of all in some quarry. I think it was limestone for making cement or something. I can't quite remember the quarry, which he said wasn't too bad because trickling out of the cracks, and that was clean, fresh, filtered water. You could drink, and you had your handful of rice and your dollop of abattoir mix. And then and you had fresh water. But the worst situations was where you had one ration to one drink of water a day, which they rationed out by filling a mug to the brim and handing it out for 20 men. Now, you, in other words, saying, you fight out amongst yourself. If the first one drinks half of it, you sort him out. This is your ration for 20. So they had to learn to take little sips, you know. And then, very often, the Japanese say, break over, back to work. And because you're taking little sips, and you didn't want to be greedy, and you didn't want to drink more than your fair share and do the dirty on your mates, you hadn't actually drunk it all. So you'd be running back to work with your hand over the mug to save that last little drop, and you put it somewhere safe and start digging, and then, but you weren't allowed any more breaks for drinks, so you had to find a way of offering this around again, like to drink the last third of a mug of water. I mean, that desperate, without the guards noticing. Although, I've painted a picture of every guard and every NC Japanese guard, every Japanese NCO, every Japanese officer being a horrible monster. But actually, there again, you had some of them that had human feelings, and you had some of the guards in this drinking, saving of the water and drinking it in between breaks, which you weren't supposed to do. Some of them would turn a blind eye, apparently, and things like that. Because if a superior officer was watching, they would have to. But you quickly learned. Charlie would say you could read the situation in a, what we would now say, a nanosecond, in a fraction of a second. You'd learn to read the whole scene. NCO watches superior officer. So NCO turns on corporal and says, "You're not doing that. What are those men doing? You've been instructed." Oh, bang! So that the officer doesn't get blamed by the commandant, who is the colonel, for allowing the NCO to allow the corporal, to allow the private, to allow the men to have a drink. So that was the situation. And he says it's remarkable how quickly you sussed out the situation in an instant, and you knew whether it was safe to do something. Might be to go and give a mate change of dressing or a drop of water who you knew was out unwell. They had a way of saying to the guards in Japanese. That's another thing, you quickly learn important words. Him ill, we do his work. Extra. Him ill, we do work. We do his work right. And they'd lay him in the shade. Well, strictly speaking, that wasn't permitted. Everybody had to work, unless you were dead. That was the only excuse. You could get out of work only if you were dead. That was the law. But some of the guards, again, you know, they would turn away. Deliberate. I mean, when we talk about turning a blind eye, If they saw something like that going on, like you've said to the guard, the guard that's watching this group, he's ill. We do his work. Then the guard would look at the NCO, the sergeant, and see whether the sergeant was looking that way. If the sergeant turned around and looked the other way deliberately, as part of a performance, really. I haven't seen anything. Then the corporal would say to the private, "Okay, you do extra work." And so they did. So you've got some blokes, some troops doing three men's work. I don't know how they measured the work, but you know, if that situation happened a number of times, you find you're working. But then you can't, you know, if the blokes got dysentery or something, or feeling really, really ill, yeah. You have to try to. I mean, most of the time the Japanese didn't try to cure anybody, except towards the end. I think the first time the commandant asked if they were all right and was there anything they needed, everybody is fainting with shock. He had an assembly, a parade. And the interpreter says, the commandant asks, are you all well and happy and is there anything you need? What? They're all fainting with shock. What? What's that? And somebody says, it's bloody obvious what's happened. They've had a defeat. They've somewhere or other, they've got an awful feeling they're not going to win this war. It's fucking obvious. But they didn't have any news about the American invasion of the islands and the gradual, you know, pushing the Japanese back. They didn't hear about that. No radio. In the early days, some tried to keep their little pocket little radios, but the Japanese just stamped on them, you know, and issued notices, anybody with a radio would be shot instantly. And all those in the same hut. I mean, that was the way they did it. So they didn't know what was going on, but this sudden change, I mean, it was so obvious. And then later on, things like, I hope you will tell your people when they come that we've treated you well. So, oh, well, victory's on the way, you know, all like that. And, well, that wasn't the end of it. They lined up, they took them to, back to Singapore. Some went to Bangkok.